Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. And let's talk again about consciousness. How much of it have we learned in recent shows with our author, Shelley Joy, who's back again to talk about the contents of her new book, The Electromagnetic Brain, EM Field Theories on the Nature of Consciousness. So this is, I'm so excited because don't we all want to think better? Maybe it's not about thinking, maybe it's about just being awake better. So to help us understand all this, and we're going to go back in time with her too, because she's really mapped the evolution of science about consciousness. And that's all in her book. So, Shelley Joy, welcome back to Energy Stew.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, great. Let's talk about where this started in modern times. I mean, we could go back to ancient masters of the Yoga Sutras, etc. But now we're really looking at modern science and how that has grown from over 100 years ago. So where would you like to start?
Well, a good place to start would be the late 1800s. I guess that's the 19th century, and then the early 1900s. It was a very new idea, sort of at East and West, started with a Theosophical Society exploring consciousness using Asian mysticism techniques like yoga, Patanjali's yoga. The people then, like Madame Blavatsky and her, you know, James Olcott, they were all interested in seances and what you could do with developing new modes of perception of the invisible world, the higher worlds, they call them. Well, at the same time, we have the first science that actually dealt with the invisible, totally invisible things that nobody could see or measure or see. And that's the electromagnetic field. Electromagnetic waves and electromagnetism was pioneered by James Clerk Maxwell in sort of the mid 1800s, 1870 or 80. And his equation showed that there were invisible waves called electromagnetic fields that extended everywhere, and that these were the source of a lot of the new experiments they were doing with spark generators and gaps and things. And he couldn't prove that they existed until about 10 or 12 years later, when Heinrich Hertz, I think they named the car company after him, but Hertz is the one who actually measured in the laboratory the electromagnetic field phenomena. And that sort of dovetailed with consciousness even. Some of the early psychologists, like William James, who's been called the father of American psychology, he was really interested in exploring consciousness, the invisible, through introspection, through direct experiment. And to do that, he actually himself took what we call laughing gas, and he tried some other drugs, we would call them entheogens, opium and things, and tried to explore firsthand consciousness in this invisible world. And then we had the real breakthrough was in 1899 when Max Planck, a German, wrote a paper which actually started quantum mechanics. And they were trying to find out what kind of mathematics they could use to track things that had to do with heat and information, especially heat flow between materials. Of course, it was the high time of the industrial age when steam locomotives and machines were being made. And the more they could learn about thermal energy, the better they could make the steam engines and even the combustion engines with hydrocarbons. So their graphs that they used at the time with the math that they used didn't quite fit the curves that they would measure in the laboratory or near a blast furnace at really high temperatures. And we in our generation should know that high temperatures correlate with high frequencies. In other words, if you look at a glowing a match, you can't even actually look into a blast furnace. It would hurt your eyes because the temperatures are higher, but also the frequency is coming out. Now, much like looking at the sun, very high frequencies are associated with the highest temperatures. And these high frequencies are also very small wavelengths, very, very, very tiny. So the higher the frequency, the smaller the dimensions of the thing we're talking about. And Max Planck, actually using three or four universal constants, the speed of light and gravity and a couple of other things, showed that you can't get smaller than what he called the Planck length. There's a limit to how small things get. And down at the Planck length would be the highest frequency and of course the greatest heat. But of course it's very, very, very small dimensions. So they wouldn't generate much heat, the individual particles spinning at such speeds. So consciousness actually was starting to be associated with some quantum mechanics. Einstein was even interested in it to some extent, but it was pretty much shut down and split. The split between psychology and consciousness and electromagnetic physics in the 1920s, when the Russian Pavlov started doing experiments with behavior, observing the behavior of dogs. And psychology really drifted into departing from physics, not trying to understand the psyche or the mind with physics, but mostly as a behavior, like observing behaviors and coming up with theories about why people do things and statistics, a lot of statistics. So pretty much the highest mathematics used by psychologists these days, even in research, are statistical things, not anything to do with electrical engineering or quantum mechanics or physics. The same thing in quantum mechanics and physics and electrical engineering, they had very little to do with consciousness. In fact, I was very interested in consciousness as a young engineer, and I kept asking different professors where I could go to study about it. And they said, well, we don't deal with those things. You'd have to go study philosophy or psychology. And of course, those departments didn't know enough physics or mathematics to start to relate them So there's a huge gap.
New scientists to combine them.
Really a big gap. But there was something that began in the 20s. People started looking for brain scientists, might call them, neurophysicists and neurophysiologists and psychologists. They were interested with memories. Where are the humans store memories? And they thought they would be able to find out pretty quickly by they would train monkeys to do things, and then they would remove parts of their brain and see if they could remove the memory. And then they would know that part of the brain was where the memory was stored. Of course, they don't do those experiments these days because of PETA and other people are, you know, worrying about the monkeys. The poor monkeys having their brains removed was kind of sad. But they got to the point where they would remove almost the entire corpus callosum, the main part of the brain. And the monkeys would still be able to repeat the training patterns they had been taught. In order to get more food, they had to do complicated tasks. So Carl Pribram is one of the brain scientists who made a breakthrough into consciousness in the 60s or 70s. He started out working in the 40s people trying to experiment with the monkeys to find the memory locations. And they made no progress until he heard about holograms. In the mid 60s, the first holograms were starting to be made. And he realized that so much information can be stored in a hologram, which is the intersection of frequencies, optical frequencies basically. But he thought that, well, maybe memories are stored holographically somewhere. Maybe not in individual neurons in the brain, but maybe spatially in the brain somehow. And He met a physicist named David Bohm, who had a very similar idea that the universe is divided into two regions. One is the explicate order, where everything is explicitly manifest in time and space, physically. We would call it physically because we use our senses to find things in space and in time. But according to quantum mechanics, there are at least seven more dimensions beyond space and time. And Bohm pretty much thought that this implicate order was where these other dimensions existed without space or without time. And in these dimensions is where memory is stored. Pure frequency memories are stored. And because I studied a lot of strangely non-interconnected subjects, like I not only studied the physics and engineering, but I studied yoga and Asian philosophies, especially Taoism and Tibetan Vajrayana and Patanjali Sutras. And I've always been interested in consciousness from both a scientific and a sort of a metaphysical point of view, the traditional ways. Well, Bohm himself believed that consciousness resides in the implicate order, and that this consciousness, this one consciousness, projects the universe into space and time from these other dimensions. And of course, I started realizing that the mystics who are able to see things in other dimensions, other regions, they call them higher dimensions, they must have developed something in their bodies, in their physiology, or somehow reprogrammed their brain in order to come up with new systems of perception. You know, we have our own typical perceptual systems of the eye, you know, vision and sound. Our ears can are designed to pick up the vibration of molecules in air, frequency waves in air that's vibrating, and translate them into what we call sound. But according to the mystics, there's other dimensions that we can use to be aware of non-spatial and non-visual dimensions. So because I did also experimented with entheogens in my 20s quite a lot, I was realizing that while you're under the influence of entheogens, your sensory systems actually do expand. And I think new sensory systems are activated. Maybe there are sensory systems that are on the verge of being activated through evolution, you know, because our eyes evolved over the last several hundred million years at least. And so did our hearing. The early microorganisms couldn't really see the way we do for sure. They didn't have eyeballs and the software of their brain to process it all. So we as humans right now may be on the verge, or maybe have been for a few centuries or more, of developing our own new senses, our own new sensory systems beyond sight and, you know, vision and sound and touch. And some people realize that there are techniques you can practice to begin to develop these new sensory systems and turn them on, activate them. And I would say those people are the yogis and the shamans and even the saints who have given people different ways of, they call them prayer or meditation or mindfulness. There's a growing number of people that combine those approaches with taking psychedelics, what I called when I was a hippie, psychedelics. Now they're called entheogens because they, I think the word in Greek means closer to God, sort of God, God revealing. We don't have to say that we actually see God on LSD, although that's probably why I first took it when I was 21. I'd been told I would see God and I had a few questions for God, but there are other levels of awareness, and there are other, I believe, and many people have written about their own belief, that there are other entities in the universe that are conscious, and that consciousness is not just an aspect of human beings and animals, but consciousness underlies the whole universe itself. And of course, David Baum, the physicist, going back to him, he would say that consciousness resides in the implicate order in these other dimensions. And it consciousness, this large, enormous network of consciousness projects what we see as the universe into space and time. So space and time is only one smaller part of the universe. And physicists who, especially particle physicists, they sort of support that idea because of dark matter and dark energy. There's a lot more of that, what they call dark energy and dark matter, a lot more of that than what we can see as energy in our space-time universe.
So well, can I just introduce the idea from my point of view of not being a scientist, is that we're drawn to being smarter, wiser, more aware on a level beyond our simple minds. And because we see that, you know, there are people in the world who have access to more brilliance than some of our minds can have access to. And how do they get to those places of knowledge? You know, like 11-year-olds who are getting their PhDs. And, you know, what is it that is different? It's not all in the brain, because science thinks that everything is just in the brain and good luck. But now we're looking at accessing these other realms and how well we can or not apply ourselves to other realms of consciousness. And what are they? And how is information held in the universe in ways that we can understand it? And so I think the hologram is a perfect example, because how can so much knowledge just be held like on the other side of the veil, let's call it? All the knowledge in the universe can be held there, and it's a hologram. But I've always thought of holographic film, that if you look at it, it's just a lot of gibberish on it. You can't identify any information in it. It's just a lot of squiggles. And then you shine a laser on it and it projects a three-dimensionally perfectly formed object. And you can do that anywhere on the film. So it means that every part of the film holds the whole. And so the amount of knowledge in a hologram is probably infinite. And so the laser must be consciousness that accesses this hologram and has access to infinite knowledge. And so maybe this part of the universe that is on the other side of, it's called the veil, there are other names for it that are scientific, that we can access through, you know, maybe the Yoga Sutras or entheogens, different ways that we can access this universe and expand our consciousness and have access to infinite knowledge. And so that to me allows the possibility to exist of us for the future for our awareness to grow substantially. How does that sound?
Yeah, well, I think what shamans and mystics have discovered is how to go through the gateway from our world of four dimensions, time and space, go through a gateway or a portal into the higher worlds of the seven dimensions that we know very little about in science, which mystics and shamans have explored and come back to tell us about. That gateway would be very, very small, because even the physicists who don't explore consciousness say that these other seven dimensions must be extremely small they're smaller than space. So what do I mean when they say smaller than space? Well, I mentioned Max Planck. His Planck length was the smallest distance that can be found in space.
Right. We talked about this in our last show, that it was like 10 to the minus 35 or something. Like
10 to the minus 35. So if you're Alice in Wonderland and you take a mushroom, you shrink down smaller and smaller and smaller. There's a limit to how far you can shrink before you get to the 10 to the minus 35 meter. And within that 10 to the minus 35 meter, smaller than that, you drop out of space into the implicate order, into David Bohm's implicate order, where the other seven dimensions are. So the idea is centering, that this implicate order is everywhere in our space-time universe, and where you find it is in the center of any particular point. So you could start with your heart, which is, you know, a few inches in diameter, and you could shrink down smaller and smaller. And as your consciousness, you're able to tune it to smaller dimensions, the frequencies are rising. So see, they're opposite. A smaller wavelength is a higher frequency. So, and these higher frequencies are able to handle higher information rates, which are higher consciousness. And so the highest consciousness are at the smallest dimensions. And what they have posited is that the universe is really a projection from the implicate order everywhere, which is at the very, very smallest dimensions. Think of a tiny point out of which the universe is emerging three-dimensionally in like a spheres, nested spheres that emanate out from the very small dimensions to the large dimension. So the universe is being projected out of the implicate order, but all of the information in the universe, the time space measurements that scientists usually make, that's actually flowing the opposite direction back down into the implicate order where it's stored forever, because there is no time there. It's timeless. It's a transcendent place where all information is stored. And that's why David Bohm and Carl Pribram believe that memory is stored. Memories holographically are stored in the implicate order. So at these extremely small dimensions within each of us, you can actually reach the portal to go through the portal into these other dimensions to perceive things. And the techniques to do that are things that each person has to learn themselves. Some people, rare people, have been born being able to do it. They're called people who are born, you know, with mystical capabilities, ESP or whatever you want to say it. But most people, like shamans and yogis, and saints even, have to practice certain practices that we call mindfulness or prayer or meditation or contemplative practices.
Right, and entheogens, and drugs can take you there too.
Yes, drugs can take you there, although not being really prepared for it can cause problems. Because in order to, the way all traditions really teach is that before you start getting connected to these higher dimensions, you need to sort of clean up your life and your health and your body. There are certain things like, trying to be honest and loving and developing a lot of good qualities, so that when you meditate, and the first step of meditation is meditative quiescence. You're trying to get very quiet inside, trying to calm down the monkey mind, which will jump all over the place. Your mind is like a computer that won't shut up. And when you're trying to meditate, it's like you're trying to read something that you bring up on your iPhone or your computer screen, and a window pops up and you say, get out of here. You know, I was reading something and I get interrupted with an advertisement or something. So the idea is to shut down your minds, get it very peaceful and quiet, and learn how to control it. And then that leads to contemplative insight. And why they call it insight, Rudolf Steiner, who was trained in engineering, also calls it insight. Because you're looking inside yourself. You're looking within, like Alice in Wonderland, at smaller dimensions that have a higher resonance consciousness frequency. And if you're able to get very quiet and establish the bridge, the link, to go through to the center where the implicate order is, where the holographic information of all your life is recorded, you can actually also connect to the lives and information that was stored by all of your relatives who have crossed to the other side.
This is amazing. We're getting near the end of the show, and I'm so fascinated by what you're saying. And I just feel like we should think of ourselves as being extremely powerful, that we can shrink down smaller than an atom to get into this other realm through our quiet minds and our, you know, meditative natures. We can actually access these incredibly high frequency places. So I'm excited to actually where this is going to take us for another show, because this is so fascinating and I'm so glad.
Yeah, well, maybe next time we can talk about some actual practices. I've integrated a lot of different ways that people have learned to get to these portals and go through them.
That's wonderful.
And, ideas.
And even talk about things like the morphogenic field, you know, interesting ideas. So Shelley Joy, thanks so much for being back on Energy Stew. Your book is the Electromagnetic Brain. That is so fascinating, as you are. And they can find you through Shelley, S-H-E-L-L-I, Joy, J-O-Y-E, .net, right? Is that it?
Yes, yeah.
Okay, good. So thanks so much.
Glad to be with you.
Oh, I'm so happy. Thanks for all that you have to offer. And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at PRN.FM. I can be reached at peter@heartriver, heartriver.org. I'd love to hear from you, and thanks so much for listening.